Welcome to Your Turn. This is Mike Causey. Glad to have you with us. And we've got to have another Follow the Money show today. We have two outstanding guests. We're going to be talking with Gerald Canizzaro. He's a retirement planning and financial specialist. He's going to be talking about your thrift savings plan. And then the second half of the hour, John Elliott, a benefits strategist, is going to talk about living with and surviving a federal employee, which is a more serious subject than it sounds. Jerry, are you with us?
Yeah, I sure am.
Hey, thank you for coming on today and everything. The reason for this show is a listener to another show here on WFED heard you talking about the L funds. And if I got it correctly, he said that you were not particularly a fan of the federal L funds as they're constituted now, and you'd like to see some changes. First off, can you explain to people what an L fund is?
Well, an L fund is what they call a life cycle fund, and it's with the TSP. It is a mix of the five basic index funds that TSP offers the federal employees. So an L fund is a professionally determined investment mix, and it's tailored to meet investment objectives based on time horizons. Okay, that would be, for instance, if you're going to retire in 2013, you would 2030. You would pick a 2030 L fund, or if you're going to retire in 2040, a 2040 L fund, etc. So what it is pretty much what we call an automatic, okay, investment, in that you put your money in to the L fund. The professionals are there to, you know, move and allocate this money over time in order to come up with a certain return at the expected time of, let's say, the end of the fund, which would be, let's say, your retirement.
So the idea is the younger you are, the longer you have to go until you start tapping that TSP account, the more aggressive your account should be, as in a larger percentage of it in stocks as opposed to bonds or the Treasury Securities G Fund. Huh?
Well, this, Mike, is where I really kind of differ.
Okay.
Okay. You know, as you know, I'm an instructor for many government seminars on pre-retirement planning and mid-career planning. And in those seminars, I have a special allocation that I give to the seminar participants based on how I see the allocations should be in the TSP index funds. Now, I honestly think that the L funds, and most of the L funds now, are far too aggressive in stocks. And I say that because when you look at the studies that have been done by many different companies, okay, you see a very higher level of risk after you go beyond 65% of your total investment money in stocks. What happens is you get more risk beyond that for every percentage you go beyond that versus the return that you actually receive from going beyond that. So I think, you know, most of these funds, well, a lot of the older, the longer funds, the 2030, 2040, okay, have too much equity in them, okay? And I'm looking right here at the 2040 fund, which has 80% of its money in equities. Now, you know, to me, I couldn't do that. I couldn't do that to a client that was age 40, more or less somebody was age 50.
Well, you know, that's interesting because that's sort of the exact opposite of what so many people have said all along, because I know someone who's going to start tapping their money, I think, in 2030 or mm-hmm. thereabouts, but he went into the 2040 fund because it was more aggressive.
Yeah, but I think people don't understand, and if they didn't understand how risk works in the market after 2008, then something was wrong. Okay, I mean, in 2008, we had a devastating market. And in 2008, most people's portfolios, and especially these later or longer L funds with the higher percentage of money invested in stocks, okay, took a very big hit, okay, because of the 2008 market. So, I mean, if let's suppose somebody was going to retire in 2010, okay, and took that fund, okay, what's happened to their money? Okay. Again, what I see here is some people just don't have an understanding of risk, and I think that's one of the issues I have with the L funds. The issue I have is I don't think that they're explained well to the federal employees. When I talk to people in seminars and ask them, what do you mean? What do you think the L fund does for you? Why did you do that? Okay, they said, well, I don't have to do anything. I just put my money in there, and then I don't have to do anything. I said, but do you understand the risk you're taking? No, I don't. I said, well, you maybe ought to look into this a little bit more because, you know, there is risk here, and you may not want that risk level. Maybe you think just by putting it in somebody's hands that you don't have risk, but in fact you do.
Well, during the 1990s, had the L funds existed, people would have made out like bandits, correct? I mean, everybody did.
Well, the L funds have only been around here for
5 years, yeah.
About 5 years.
Right.
So they haven't gone through, I guess they've gone through a little bit in the 1990s, they would have made out like a bandit.
Right.
But everybody made out like a bandit. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it's easy to make money in an up market, Mike. I mean, the problem here is, you know, as you go through these markets year after year, okay, I advocate that, you know, you should have money, you know, invested in stocks for sure. But, you know, you need some downside protection. Okay, but you need that downside protection no matter how young you are or how old you are. And I think the problem I have, again, with the L funds is that, you know, that especially their 2030, 2040 are just too far aggressive in stocks.
That's so interesting because the argument up to now for many mm-hmm. people has been that they're not aggressive enough. And that one thing I was going to ask you, it would seem to me that, you know, I'm one of these people who I know what I don't know. Right, or I know what I don't know, and so I'm happy to have a professional handle it. And it seems to me that, you know, unless you want to go to an individual broker or financial planner, if you're going to do this within the TSP, then maybe the best bet would be for everybody who's in it, or virtually everybody who's in it, to get into one of the more conservative funds, like a 2010 to present income, or 2010, where you'd have a much lesser exposure to the stock market. But I'd still have a professional mix, and I'd have it being reallocated and rebalanced on a regular basis.
Well, a 2010, I would be more conservative. There's no doubt about that. But when you take a look, and I'm taking a look right now, okay, at some of the record of the L fund over the years, okay, and I'm looking at the L fund 2010. Did you know that you would have made out better? Okay, in the G fund since its inception, because the L 2010 since its inception, this is off TSP website, okay, had a 3.69 okay annualized return, and the G fund had a 6.15% return.
Okay, that's taking that big hit of the
that's 2008. And the F fund had 7.10%.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, I mean, you know, if you're sitting there saying, I want to be conservative, you know, according to these stats, you would have been better off in either the G or the F fund versus, let's say, the L fund over this, you know, longer period, this period of time. Now, again, you know, the G fund and the F fund have been around longer, but again, they were also there the same number of years as the L 2010 or the income fund. Okay, which, again, was supposed to, you know, basically say, okay, here's your money, and we've got it safe for you. But you know that the ELF, the income fund also has some money in stocks, okay, and I'm not against that, but just remember that's it does. And so it's not purely an income-driven fund.
Well, what about the argument, again, this is a professionally based fund, that what it's 2030, 2040, 2010. This is a pros idea of how your portfolio should be allocated between stocks, bonds, and G fund. The other argument is that it's rebalanced regularly. And for instance, in 2008, the conventional wisdom is, you know, people buy low, sell high. And in 2008, people were buying low. So I would think that an L fund, and again, this is over a long period of time, would have done what most people didn't. Most people during in 2008, 2009 ran away from the stock market. So you could argue that they maybe sold low, and when they decide to come back in, they'll be buying high, whereas the people in the L fund doing nothing unwittingly were probably buying stocks at what may be a sale price.
Well, here's what's happened. I mean, I certainly believe in rebalancing, and we advocate, and I advocate to my seminar participants that they rebalance twice a year. But when you read the L fund literature off of the TSB website, the way they rebalance is not to look at everything, all the funds that they have their money invested in. What they do is they evidently take and reduce the amount or the percentage, okay, of money that they have in each of the funds. In other words, if I had 80% in stocks, I might the next year reduce that to 79%. But it doesn't seem to say, from what I can read here, that they do an actual rebalance. That is,
I see. Jerry, excuse me, can I interrupt you here? We need to take a short break.
Yeah,
I'm talking with Gerald Canizaro about the Thrift Savings Plan, the L funds in particular. We'll be right back here on WFED 1500 AM. Back to Your Turn. This is Mike Causey, and I'm talking with Jerry Canizaro. He's a financial planner. We've been talking about the pros and cons, and as Jerry sees it, there are many cons with the L fund. These are the life cycle funds that that let you sort of fire and forget or automatic pilot. You pick the target date closest to when you think you're going to be withdrawing your money from this L fund, and then it sets a portfolio balance for you that's readjusted, and it gets more conservative as you get nearer to the time when you'll be tapping the money. But Jerry believes that in some cases, and this is a very interesting take, that the L funds are too aggressive in that they're overly exposed to stocks, correct?
I do, and you know, I think the reason I say that is because the how you make money in stocks today is not so much how much money you have invested in stocks, but where the money is distributed within the overall stock market. How that money is distributed within, and I say this also, within the worldwide investment market, because we are in a worldwide investment market. So it's where the money is within the worldwide investment market that is really more responsible for how much money you make versus how much, you know, how high the percentage of your overall portfolio that is invested in stocks.
Right. Well, now the international fund, the I fund, which is a component of the L funds are in fact a fund of funds.
That's
and
correct.
And the I fund is one of the components in it. And you're critical of that one as well, correct?
Absolutely. I am critical of the I fund because, again, even though I advocate in my my seminars that people put 25%, okay, of their money in the I fund, that is, you know, from the age, let's say, 30 up to age 60, in order to get, you know, some of that return from the international marketplace, the L fund, okay, the index that they're currently using for that, okay, is limiting. And it is limiting in a sense, and that the particular index does not cover some of the better investment options in the international marketplace.
I believe the I fund now is indexed to, it's something called the EAFE, which I think stands
EAFE,
for...
EAFE, yes.
Yeah, is that Europe, Australia, and the Far East?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. But the problem there with the I fund is that the I fund, okay, misses, okay, many, okay, of the best investment opportunities or foreign opportunities today, because what it doesn't do is it doesn't include, okay, some of the countries where they're making the most money, such as the emerging market countries of China, of India, of Russia, in those areas. And you know, it's and that those particular countries are where the money is being made internationally, but the I Fund doesn't have any money in any of those that I mentioned. And so the index itself, okay, is not really good as far as capturing the overall international marketplace. And it does absolutely have limitations.
Jerry, the average federal worker today, I believe, is about 47 years old, meaning they have about 15 years to go toward retirement.
Mm-hmm.
And for many of them, because of the annuity, even though most of them it will be a reduced annuity under the FERS system, but they will get an annuity that's indexed to inflation. So many federal retirees can wait longer and let their money ride in the thrift savings plan regardless of their status. If you were a 47-year-old Fed with 15 years to go to retirement and then maybe 20 or more years to go until you started tapping the TSP or until you had to start tapping it at age 70, what would your investment mix be?
Well, I mean, my investment mix from age 30 to age 60, and I mean, again, I'm just talking about 30-year-olds or coming in maybe at that point into the federal workforce. I advocate a 60% stocks, 30% bonds, and 10% cash. Out of the 60% in stocks, I recommend 15% in the C fund, 20% in the S fund, and 25% in the I fund, 30% in the F fund, and 10% in the G fund. And I also advocate rebalancing twice a year, okay, in January and in October, the first 2 weeks of each one of those months, rebalance, back to those percentages I gave you.
Okay, all right. And so that you can do that on your own?
Oh, absolutely. You can do that through the TSP website.
I'm a tad math challenge.
Yeah.
So I was here. But listen, Jerry, we're getting the
very
signal. We're getting the signal to leave here. But thank you very much. And we're gonna put your email address, if we may, up on our website.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. Thanks for having me.
You're with Retirement Planning Services in Virginia, correct?
Yes, indeed.
Thanks, Jerry. Thank you. And we'll be right back here in a few minutes. We'll be talking with John Elliott about surviving a federal worker here on WFED 1500 AM. Back to your turn. This is Mike Causey. Glad to have you with us today and every Wednesday here at 10 a.m. Try to keep the show on track and follow the money as much as possible. And we just finished talking with Gerald Canizzaro, and he was talking about the pros and cons, mostly the cons in his point of view, of the L fund, the life cycle funds offered by the Thrift Savings Plan. Now we're going to turn to living with a federal worker. And our guest is John Elliott. He's well known to listeners of this station. John is a regular feature with the National Institute of Transition Planning, and he is an instructor with NITP and goes around to various federal agencies. And John, I was looking at, pulling this out of my head here. You've worked for Defense, OPM, Agriculture, Customs, and DEA, so you not only know the waterfront of agency by agency, but also you're familiar with law enforcement regulations and special retirements, which are different for people in law enforcement, air traffic controllers, and the like, huh?
Yes, that's right.
That's good. John, you wanted to talk about surviving a federal worker, and we thought it's a witty title. It's also a very serious business. And I would guess, and I know very next to nothing about it, but I would think that probably many federal workers don't understand what their rights and benefits are as a federal worker or as the spouse of a federal worker.
Well, they don't. We get a lot of questions on that. And why don't we just start with what happens if you as a federal employee, or maybe you're married to a federal employee, what happens if the federal employee dies while still employed?
Great.
God forbid they don't make it to retirement. But and then we'll move into later in life.
Right.
But if a federal employee dies in service, as they say, and they're married, their spouse is entitled to automatic benefits. Let's take the FERS first, because naturally FERS and CERS are different. But most federal employees these days are covered by FERS, so we'll take them first. If you have a surviving spouse, he or she will automatically get $29,000 and change, plus half your final salary in a lump sum payment. And it's $29,700 and some odd, and then some cents. And why that odd number is because when the FERS started, it was a flat $15,000, and that amount is increased by COLAs every year, except last year, of course, and presumably this year. But so that almost $30,000 if you die this year, and plus half of your annual salary, because somebody in a seminar asked, is that your monthly salary or biweekly salary? No, it's your annual salary. So that's a fairly sizable chunk of money. And then if you had 10 years of service when you died, your spouse will also get an annuity equal to half of your earned annuity under the FERS regular formula. And there's more. If he or she was under your family health plan, they will automatically be able to continue in the very valuable federal health benefits program as well, but only if when you died they were covered under your family plan can they do that. So that's what a surviving spouse of a federal employee under FERS would get. CERS, a little different. They get 55% of your earned CSRS benefit, which potentially is a more generous benefit. They don't get a lump sum payment like the FERS widow and widowers, but they get a more generous annuity typically. And there's a floor below which the surviving spouse can't go, and it's 40%. They'd get 55% of your high three average salary, computed through your date of death, but they can't go lower than 40% of 55% of your high three, which means if you died as a CERS employee, and there are not too many left of those, with less than 22 years of service, you would get what they call a guaranteed minimum benefit. But, of course, most CERS people now have well over 22 years. So those people, and that's really the population we're talking about, those people, those surviving spouses would get 55% of your earned CERS annuity based on how ever many years and months of service you had when you died. So that's the death in service crowd. And same rules apply to the health benefits. If they were covered under your family plan, they will continue in the health benefits program. So,
well, that's fascinating. That's much much more generous than any private plans that I know of.
Yeah, that's a lot of protection for the spouses of federal employees. So when you're planning, you know, your life insurance needs, you need to factor in those benefits. Maybe you can cut back on some life insurance premiums.
Yeah, that's real. And not to nitpick here, but in the first thing you mentioned that they get a $29,000 payment and change.
It's
payment.
Almost $30,000.
Right,
$29,700 and some.
Right, $29,000 and change plus half of the final salary. And this is where the nitpicking part comes in. But does that mean half of the annual salary, whether the employee died say January 2nd or December 31st?
Well, it's just half of the final
half the salary,
half the salary, whatever he happens to be earning, that's the payment.
Okay, all right, and it wouldn't matter what time of
it would not.
Okay, good. And then the CSRS, while there's no lump sum payment, there is that generous lifetime benefit that's fully indexed to inflation, assuming there is inflation.
Right.
Well, I imagine in your seminars that that light bulbs go off in people's heads when they hear this.
Well, I think there may be some measure of relief knowing that their spouses are provided for in a fairly generous fashion. And these are automatic payments if you die with a spouse left behind. So
yeah, they're automatic, yeah. Except for the health insurance coverage. And that, in that case, I'd have to be in a family plan.
Yeah, and many non one-fed families where the others, the surviving spouse, wouldn't is not a federal employee. That's often the case. That's more often the case anyway than not, I would guess. But, yeah, if you're worried about the federal health benefits plan for your surviving spouse, in all cases, he or she has to be under your family plan on the date you die. So that's an important consideration.
And that's, I know you've, I've heard you tell this to people before, but this is a case where you, it, during the open season, you buy health insurance so you can keep health insurance. And that is, you know, your non-federal spouse may be covered by a better plan, may have lower premiums, but in many cases, if you really want to take care of them, you cover them, you buy a family plan, maybe even get a low-cost family plan, but just to provide coverage for them.
Yeah, yeah. Then there's the, you know, you've talked about it quite a bit, and is the 5-year requirement rule in order to carry your health benefits into retirement. You have to have be enrolled, you as a federal employee, 5 years immediately preceding retirement in any of the plans, and then you have to retire with title to an immediate annuity, and then you can carry. You have lifetime health benefits. Now, in order to ensure your spouse in retirement, your retirement, that he or she would have these same lifetime health benefits, you would have to elect a minimum survivor annuity under CSRS or FERS. You can, of course, elect a full survivor annuity. That would work as well. And then, again, you have to have them under your family plan if you die, predecease them in retirement as well, for them, and then they would have continue in the federal health benefits program for the rest of their life at the same cost and coverage as a federal employee.
Well, tricky stuff. Listen, we need to take a short break here, but I'm talking with John Elliott, benefit strategist, and we'll be right back here on WFED 1500 AM.
Have you delayed?
Welcome back to Your Turn. This is Mike Causing. I'm talking with John Elliott. He is a benefits strategist and expert, works frequently with the National Institute of Transition Planning, and probably know him from, he's also done a number of wonderful guest columns for me, and I can see one coming up out of this, John, what you just explained about the survivor benefits things. That last commercial made me think, they used the word domestic. Do any of these benefits include domestic partners?
You have to be married.
Okay.
So, no, they don't. That's the benefits dog barking.
Yes.
Yeah, she is not married, my dog, so she would be not entitled to the benefits I just described.
I can hear the rage, yes.
Yes, yeah, she gets pretty excited. But let me close the door. And that will minimize her bark.
That's guaranteed. I once was, did a show with Brian Lamb and of CNN, and a lady called in with a parrot, and that was amusing. I bet he remembers that.
Yeah, but since you brought it up, at retirement, when you're filling out your retirement application, whether it's for FERS or CSRS, there is such a thing called an insurable interest annuity, where you could provide an annuity, a monthly payment for the survivor for the rest of his or her life, and that could be a domestic partner if they're financially dependent upon you. So there is a way, if you die in service, you can't. I mean, there are no automatic payments to
right.
domestic partners, but you could get this insurable interest annuity, and you'll see it on the FERS and CSRS application. There's a box for that, and you can sign up for that. Unlike the other annuities where you could be in horrible health at death's door and still provide your spouse with full survivor benefits, which of course you'd want to do, you have to prove you're in good health. And I think it's the requirement, as I recall, is you have to submit a physical taken 6 months before you retire to prove you're not going to die on them too soon. And the benefits are the same for FERS and CSRS. It's one of those instances where FERS and CSRS are the same. And the surviving spouse would get 55% of the benefit after the reduction is applied. Well, yes, you have to pay for these, and it reduces your annuity by a percentage. Now, if the, say, domestic partner is within, is less than 5 years younger than you are, or of course the same age or older, that reduction is 10% of your annuity while you're alive, of course. And that's not too bad, and they'd get 55% after the reduction is applied. In other words, 55% and 90%.
Right, okay.
Right.
And yeah, and that makes sense. Well, and it's very generous compared to the private
sector. But there's
more.
No, we can't. There's more.
Mm-hmm.
As they get younger than you, for example, if there's between 5 and but less than 10 years younger than you are, they nail you with 15% reduction. And for somebody who's 30 years younger than you or more, it's all the way up to 40%.
That's the lecher payment.
That's probably somebody trying to call me.
Okay.
It's really only a practical solution if the person is less than 5 years younger. Of course, the same age or older works too, where it's 10%. But then it starts getting to be a pretty draconian reduction. So it's not as good an idea for, you know, if you have a domestic partner or somebody you're trying to insure that's considerably younger than you are. Now, let's get back to the more conventional spousal annuity at retirement. Your spouse, whether it's a first spouse or a service spouse, is entitled by law to full survivor benefits if you're married at retirement. And only your spouse can waive their entitlement to full survivor benefits. And for FERS, full survivor benefits would be 50% of whatever your annuity was when you died. They would get 50% of that. And they're entitled to that by law. Now, if they sign this waiver form, which is part of the retirement application package, and their signature has to be witnessed by a notary, so you can't forge it, you can elect a partial survivor annuity under FERS, which is 25% to survivor. Now, what does this cost you? These are not automatic, like if you die in service. So the 50% to survivor costs you a 10% reduction to your annuity. Not surprisingly, 25% costs you only 5%. And third option would be to elect no survivor annuity under FERS, but then you couldn't insure the survivor with lifetime health benefits. You'd at least have to elect the 25% with 5% reduction. That's FERS. Under CERS, it's full survivor benefits are a little higher, 55% of whatever you were getting when you died. But if they're willing to take less, say a partial survivor annuity, there's far more flexibility. There's something called a base level where you, with your spouse's consent, can elect any dollar amount is a base level, and they'd get 55% of that base level. So, for example, say your annuity was $60,000 a year, and you said, well, your spouse says, I don't need a full survivor benefit. I just need, let me give me a partial. So they elect 30% base level. Instead of the full $60,000, $30,000 base level, and they'd get 55% of $30,000. So you can elect any dollar amount below your full annuity as a base level, and they would get 55% of that at their death.
John, let me interrupt you right there. Okay, we need to take a break here. We'll be right back. I wanted to ask you something about couples, both of whom work for the government. Be right back here on WFED 1500 AM.
Okay.
Back to your turn. This is Mike Causey. I'm talking with John Elliott. He's a longtime federal benefits expert strategist, and he works with the National Institutes of Transition Planning. And John is a frequent guest on their show For Your Benefit here on Mondays at 10 a.m. Very good show. I listen to it and learn a lot. John, I interrupted you. We were talking about survivor benefits and that sort of thing.
Yeah, you asked or were about to ask before the commercial about what about two-fed families? In other words, both spouses work for the federal government. Is that right?
Right. Yeah, and the idea is, you know, they could both be working for the government. One could be working. One could be retired. Both could be retired. What difference does it make? And what's your strategy
really
for that?
Not really anything in survivor benefits. Your federal spouse, if you're a federal retiree, has the same rules. Entitlement to full survivor benefits unless they sign the waiver form. So there's really no difference how two fed families are treated. You can elect full survivor benefits for each other, partial, no survivor benefit, or, you know, do one survivor for one, not any for the other. Totally flexible. The only difference is that unlike a one fed family, you don't have to worry about the health benefits coverage with a two-fed family. If you're a one-fed family, you have to at least, as I said before, elect the minimum survivor benefit under FERS or CERS to ensure your spouse would have lifetime coverage if you predecease him or her. That's not as a concern with a two-fed family because you're both annuitants, and therefore you... If you didn't have a survivor benefit based on your deceased federal retiree spouse, if you're an annuitant or going to be an annuitant someday, even if you're still an employee, you would be able to continue in the federal health benefits program. So that's the only difference
and
how a two-fed family is treated versus a one-fed family.
Right, and in making this decision, you know, say you and your wife, both federal workers, and you say, well, I'm going to take... I'm going to provide you a survivor benefit or not, and it could be that their annuity is such that they really don't need that protection, and it's more worthwhile for you to keep getting it as a steady stream of income monthly.
Exactly. Then you wouldn't have to provide a survivor annuity at all because your spouse would be protected under the health benefits program because they, in turn, are either a federal employee or someday an annuitant.
Right. And you mentioned at the beginning when you were talking about the survivor benefits under CERS and FERS that this might, if you understand those benefits, know what they are and utilize them, maximize them, might make a difference in what kind of insurance, life insurance you buy, huh?
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly part of your benefits package to provide for surviving spouse. So you would then tailor your insurance needs accordingly. Maybe you could scale them back because these benefits are payable. If, you know, particularly insurance under the Federal Employees Group Life Insurance, not the basic, but the options, if you really have a lot of insurance like Option B where you can provide up to five times your salary, for your designated beneficiary or a spouse, say, that gets very expensive as you age. So, you know, just remember you've got your widow or widower has got these protections. Some people ask, and I know we're running out of time, can I substitute life insurance for survivor annuity? Sure, you can. But that may or may not be a good idea. Oftentimes, it's not as effective a way as the conventional FERS or CERS survivor annuity. You can look at it, but you got to be very careful about foregoing the survivor annuity in favor of life insurance. It can work for some, but not all.
Well, you know, just as a human factor, too, many financial planners tell you that people who come... who have a windfall of a large sum of money unexpectedly, which could be life insurance, could be the lottery, but whatever it is, that it tends to be gone within 18 months. People tend to spend it if it is in a lump sum as opposed to if you got it as a monthly benefit for your life.
Yeah, that's a good point. So if you're worried about an irresponsible survivor, that might not be insurance. Might not be.
Now, what if you retire from the government and you're widowed, your husband or wife dies, and you provide a survivor annuity for them? Does your annuity go back up?
Yes, it does. It does. That's a nice thing because should the one you're providing annuity for die first. They're not going to continue to take that 10% out of your annuity or 5% whatever it is, out of your annuity. You just notify OPM, send in a death certificate, and they will remove that reduction prospectively with the month after your spouse dies. So,
great.
And then if you're in a family plan, they'll put you in a self-only if you don't have kids still on the plan. So
great.
You save money that way.
John,
as well.
This has been a real education. I have been making notes, and I hope I can retain some of this. We'll have you back on. John Elliott, Benefits Strategist, and thank you for being with us here on for your turn, and we'll see you next week here on WFED 1500 AM.